We welcome everyone. It's either a good morning or good afternoon, depending on your time zone. You should be here for a Clue and Internet seminar on incremental composite sampling designs for surface soil analyses. This is module 3 of a 4-part seminar series, which has been sponsored by the EPA's Office of Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division. My name is Jean Dallas. I work in that same office, and I'll be helping to moderate today's seminar. Clue-in seminars, for those of you who are new to it, function very similar to a conference call. So if you haven't done so already, you want to be sure to have a copy of the presentation materials open in front of you. When you registered for today's event, you were directed to a seminar homepage, which had a description for today's seminar, as well as listings and contact info for our presenters, links to their bios, and you also had the ability to download the PowerPoint presentation as either a PDF or PowerPoint, or you could be clicking a button on that very same page that appears on the left to go to seminar. You can choose any one of those methods, but you want to be sure you have a copy of the slides, either open on a web browser window, printed out, or pulled up electronically in front of you. Each of our presenters will be indicating as they move through the materials. So with that, I'm going to ask everyone to move along to slide number 2, where we'll cover a couple basic housekeeping items before we kick things off. Again, I've globally muted all of the phone lines, and I would ask if you're not speaking, please remain on mute. And this would go for the presenters as well. Unless you're talking, don't keep yourself muted. We have globally muted all the lines, so we won't have any disruptions unless people choose to unmute. When we get to the point for Q&A, I will remind you how you can unmute to ask questions on the phone, but until then, please stay muted. We would ask that you don't put the call on hold or do anything else that might potentially disrupt us. So again, please remain muted until we get to the Q&A breaks. Question and answer, there are periods designated throughout today's session. And again, if you're on the phones, I'll provide instructions on how to take yourself off of mute and ask them by phone. If you are listening to us online or have the slides up in a web browser window, you'll see that there are a couple of question mark icons that are along the top. They're in orange or probably orange icons, and one of them is a question mark button. If you click that question mark button, as long as your pop-up blockers have been disabled, a new window will open up which will allow you to type in an electronic comment or question. And after the designated Q&A periods, I will read your comment or question out loud so that the speakers can answer them. You don't have to wait for the designated period to submit a question electronically. You can do that at any point in time. And in fact, I would encourage you to type them up as soon as they occur to you so you can have a nice queue going and get through those questions as efficiently as possible. Again, you can also use that question mark icon to report technical difficulties you may have. If you're looking at the orange icon to the top, the single arrow will point to the right will move you forward one slide. The single arrow pointing to the left will move you backwards one slide. You can also use the numbered links that appear on the left-hand side. This event is being recorded, and we've had a very, very popular turnout. In fact, each event has about 400 people or so that's been participating from all over the world. We do understand, though, that some people weren't able to participate in all of them. There may be schedule conflicts. So if at any point you're unable to participate in any one of the modules, please know all 4 of them are being recorded and archived. And everyone who registers to participate, whether you were able to make it or not, will automatically receive an email letting me know as soon as that archive is available. And we've got the URL, again, on slide number 2, letting you know where you can find the existing archives as well as several hundred other seminars that we have available from Clue-In. I think that is the end of the official reminders that I have for everybody today. So I'm going to have everybody move along to slide number 3. And again, today's seminar is going to cover topics this is part 3 of a 4-part seminar series, which is based on an 8-hour training. And today's particular module is going to include ISM calculations and using the incremental sampling design modules of visual sample plan, or VSP. There will be two case study projects from the state of Missouri that are discussed. And again, our presenters today will be Dina Crumbling from the EPA Superfund program and Michael Stroh from the Missouri Department of Natural Resources. So leaving everyone on slide number 3, I'm going to turn it over to our presenters today.
Okay, this is Dina Crumbling, and welcome to all you folks out there in cyberspace. We'll begin with module 3.1. If you click to the next page, again, there's your instructors for today, as Jean mentioned, and today's agenda, slide 5. And since that's already been covered, we'll go on to slide 6, where we have to do the disclaimer that references to products or services and providers are for information purposes only and do not constitute endorsement. So now we're at module 3.2, which is slide 7. So we're going to talk about calculations that are used with incremental sampling. Slide 8, we're going to do a thought experiment. Imagine that you had a decision unit that was the kidney bean shape there in the blue. It's 1 cubic yard of soil, which is equivalent to 1 ton of soil. And we want to determine the concentration of lead or some other contaminant in that 1 ton of soil. Well, we could determine the concentration if we could dump that whole ton of soil into a giant digestion vessel and pour in the acid digestion and run it through the ICP instrument, and that would give us the concentration for that decision unit. There also would be no uncertainty in that answer. Now, for these thought experiments, I'm going to ignore any kind of analytical variability or variability from the instrument. Go on to slide 9. Of course, we can't do that, so we have to do sampling, which means we take part of the population and analyze them in order to get data that we then extrapolate back to represent the population that we sampled. So which design below would be most representative? Let's actually start with the C design, which is at the bottom. And that's my poor attempt at PowerPoint to convey the idea of splitting the entire site into 1 gram samples that would be analyzed for analysis, each of them. And there would be, for a ton of soil, there would be 1.4 million samples. If we were able to analyze 1.4 million 1 gram samples, and average them, we would get the absolute answer, again, for the concentration for that decision unit. And again, there would be no uncertainty as long as we're ignoring analytical uncertainty. But going back up to scenarios A and B, of course, we can't do that analysis for all of the decision units. We have to sample. But ask yourself, which would you prefer? Would you prefer data from scenario A or data from scenario B? Well, B certainly covers more of the decision unit, but even with that somewhat limited number of samples, we probably don't have the budget to do that. So a compromise is to physically composite all those 33 samples, and then they're called increments, into one pooled sample, which is called the incremental sample. No matter how we sample, if we don't do complete sampling, there is always going to be uncertainty present. So let's move on to slide 10. And we're going to work our way into why we use upper confidence limits, or UCLs, for those who might not be familiar with that. So all of our real-world data involves uncertainty because we're sampling less than the total amount of a decision unit. And we're uncertain because when we calculate a mean or obtain a mean for the data that we have, we never know for sure if the mean that we calculated is less than or greater than the true mean for the DU. And we don't know by how much it's either over or under. The more samples that we collect, the more likely it is that the calculated mean will be close to the true mean. And the figure there is just to show a physical representation of a calculated mean that's under the true concentration, which is in brown, and the blue one, which is representing a sample mean that is overestimating the true concentration. Going on to slide 11. So, EPA does not want to underestimate the mean because EPA's mandate is to be protective of human health and the environment. So, EPA uses something that's called an upper confidence limit. And we're not going to go into a long statistical discussion of this, but just as a conceptual way, as presented by the quote from the guidance from 2002, EPA recommends using the average concentration, but because of the uncertainty associated with estimating the true concentration, the 95% upper confidence limit of the arithmetic mean should be used. So what you see in the figure now is that a buffer has been added to the calculated mean, both the one that's below the true mean and to the one that's above the true mean, because we don't know if it's above or below. So we add a buffer with hopes that if our initial estimate of the mean was too low, this buffer would bring it up and make sure that the number that we use, which is called the upper confidence limit, or the UCL, is equal to or above the true mean concentration. Going on to slide 11. So there's things that influence the values of the upper confidence limit. The first thing is the number of samples that's in the data set, or N. The degree of variability that's in the data set, which is usually measured by standard deviation. The type of statistical distribution from which the data came. And if you don't understand what that means, don't worry. We'll get to it in the next couple of slides. And the degree of statistical confidence desired. Do you want 95% confidence or 99% confidence? An example of this type of buffer calculation is the equation given there in the blue box. This is based on a student's T calculation for an upper confidence limit. The equation, though, this formula, is only used for normal or near normal statistical distributions. The value of T depends on how many samples were in the data set, and the value of T also depends on the selected confidence. So if you chose 95% confidence, that's part of selecting the value of T. The higher the confidence, the higher the T value is, and the wider the buffer becomes. The higher the N, or the number of samples in the data set, the smaller the T value becomes and the narrower the buffer gets. In other words, it gets closer to the calculated mean. You might notice that N also appears in the denominator of the formula. And the higher the N, the narrower the buffer since it's in the denominator. And the standard deviation or the variability is in the numerator, which means that the higher the variability, the wider the buffer is. Let's go on to slide 13. As far as statistical distributions, each statistical distribution has its own UCL formula. So the distribution that you see on the top is a histogram of real data that has an approximate normal curve, or could be a bell, called the bell curve, or called Gaussian. All terms for the same thing. Below that is a data set showing a histogram that's close to a log normal distribution. Go on to slide 14. The slide at the top has a distribution that's called a gamma distribution. This is a distribution that's used in ProUCL. It's somewhat similar to a log normal distribution, but statisticians seem to like it better than log normal, so it's becoming more popular. But it has its own formulas for calculating a UCL. And then at the bottom, we see a distribution that doesn't resemble any of those, and it's called a non-parametric distribution, which means that the curve, if you drew it, does not fit a mathematical curve in the statistical world. But you can still have UCLs that deal with non-parametric distributions, and the Chebyshev UCL is commonly recommended. On to slide 15. So UCLs are a common mechanism to account for data uncertainty. It's often used in risk assessment. It's required by at least some state regulations. And the big question for incremental sampling is, can a UCL be calculated with incremental sampling? And the answer is yes, but it requires at least 3 replicate incremental samples. And those have to be independent replicates. Or another option is that if you have good historical data, good data from a pilot study, from another DU that's very, very similar to the DU that you want to calculate a UCL on, or any other reliable or defensible information from which an estimate of the standard deviation can be derived, you can borrow that standard deviation to use to calculate a UCL for DU which does not have at least 3 replicates. So say you had like an agricultural field where you expect most all the soil in that agricultural field to have a fairly even distribution of contamination across the entire field. You might not need to do triplicates on all the DUs that are part of that field. If you can show through your conceptual site model that these DUs are very similar, test that assumption by taking triplicates on at least a few of the DUs, and if it shows that the standard deviation does in fact hold across the area, then you can, an option is to borrow that standard deviation to calculate UCLs for the DUs that do not have triplicates. This is an option, but not all regulators may agree with that option. It depends on the person. If we go on to slide 16. Another question is, can ProUCL be used to calculate incremental sample UCLs? Well, the answer is not usually, because usually there's not enough replicate data points. Again, if we're talking just triplicate data points, there's only 3. ProUCL requires at least 5 data points to run its algorithms. That means if you only put 4 data points in, ProUCL won't calculate anything. If you put 5 in, it will calculate something, but it gives you these big warning signs that it may not be reliable because they recommend at least 8 to 10 data points for reliable UCL output. On to slide 17. So what are the UCL options for incremental sampling? Well, if we appeal to the central limit theorem, we can at least sometimes use the student's T UCL. That's potentially valid because an incremental sample result represents a mean concentration over the decision unit. Now, it's a physical mean, not a mathematical mean, but it still represents a mean, and therefore the central limit theorem can be invoked. And what the central limit theorem implies is that even if you don't have a normal distribution for your increments themselves, the mean of those increments, and you, if you do a lot of those means and plot those means, they will approach a normal distribution. So if the variability in the data set is not in your, say, three data points, If your conceptual site model indicates that there is not very much variability within the soil population that is being sampled by your increments, so in other words, the underlying soil population, if that is not too variable, even though it's not normal, you can use a central limit theorem to use the student's TUCL. If your CSM says that there's potentially a whole lot of variability within that decision unit, then you would not want to use the student's TUCL. Instead, you would use a Chebyshev UCL, which is the non-parametric UCL. It's always higher than a corresponding TUCL, even with the same number of samples and the same standard deviation. Both of these equations are very simple, and they're easily programmed into a spreadsheet. In fact, we have programmed a spreadsheet that you can download, a calculator from the webinar's resources page, and this is just simply an Excel file. And if you want to learn more about how the central limit theorem applies, I'm referencing you there to the ISM document that IPRC has put out. Slide 18. So as I mentioned, when you're choosing which UCL to use, you can use the student's T equation if you think you have relatively uniform deposition. And an example there is air deposition. Or if you have existing data that shows that there's a fairly uniform deposition. If you have discrete data or information indicating high variability, then use the Chebyshev equation. If you don't know how variable the concentrations are, use the Chebyshev. Slide 19. If you have used the sampling unit approach so that your DU is made up of several sampling units and the sampling units are of equal area or equal volume, they you can also calculate a UCL with them. But those SU results are not replicates, because if you remember how sampling units are used, they're used to maintain some information about the spatial variability, the potential for spatial hotspots. So they are not replicates. So what should you do to calculate a UCL from them? Well, you can calculate the mean the same as if the data points were discrete samples. But for calculating the UCL, if you have more than 8 sampling units that are part of a single DU, you could use ProUCL to calculate the DU. I'm sorry, to calculate the UCL for the DU. But if you have less than 8, you would either select the TUCL or the Chebyshev UCL per the instructions that we talked about before. If it ends up being pretty homogeneous across that decision unit, then you can use the TUCL. If there is any doubt whatsoever, use the Chebyshev UCL. Slide 20. if you have unequal sized sampling units, you have to do some weighting of the area or volume. You can't use ProUCL to do this because it doesn't do weighted calculations. The mean, the standard deviation, and the degrees of freedom all must be weighted to calculate the UCL. We also included a weighted calculator that can be downloaded from the resources list, and it's also an Excel file. And more information on weighting sampling units and decision units can be obtained there in the ITRC document, section 4. On slide 21, background is another big issue with incremental sampling. Can background and site incremental sample data be compared? Well, yes, but we've really limited our statistical tools if the site has only a few decision units. You have to compare apples to apples, so you cannot directly compare incremental sampling data from a site PU to background data that's been selected from discrete samples. You have to compare incremental data to incremental data. Now, there are statisticians who are working on theory and ways that we could potentially use discrete data, but right now there is no other option. There's no other way to use the discrete data. So if you're going to be doing a background comparison, we recommend that you choose a background decision unit or more than one decision unit, even optimally, in the background area that's the same size as the decision unit on your site and has the same number of increments as the decision unit on your site. Now, if you're doing a two-sample hypothesis test to distinguish whether site and background are different, ProUCL will run the two-sample test with less than 5 data points each, but the reliability of those test results can be very low. I recommend that you consult a statistician. Other statistical options for background, so possibly a background threshold value could be estimated from a background DU data set. And when you have a background threshold value, then you don't do the two-sample t-test. You take each site DU result and compare it one by one to the background threshold value. Development of the background threshold value depends on the characteristics of the data set. So again, you only need to consult a statistician to go in this direction too. Slide 23. A simple, obvious way to compare background and site DU data is to plot it on a little chart. As in this example, you have a background area and the results from the background area are plotted. And then on the site side, you have the pink squares and those three replicate results are plotted. And you look at them. So does it look like the site results are really higher than the background area? When you do this, it's desirable to have enough background data to capture the full range of background conditions. Next slide, slide 24. And we'll talk about visual sample plan a little bit because this can be used to help design your multiple increment sampling. This is a screenshot from a VSP module that does this. I'm not going to talk through the entire thing because it would take more time than we have, but you can study it on your own. I've indicated where these various numbers come from that the VSP module asks for. Basically, they come, in this case, they come from a pilot data set, and from the QC data that was performed on that, the QC procedure that was used, that was discussed on the second day, where you do replicates not only for the DU, but also replicates of subsampling in the laboratory. So that's where those numbers come from. On to slide 25. These are two screenshots of VSP. What VSP can give you is both the number of increments and the number of incremental samples to take. What you can do if you want three incremental samples is set it for a number, the number of increments that will give you three, and then ratchet down the number of increments until it flips over to say four. So in this case, with that data that was entered on the previous slide, it's telling me that I can do an MI sample consisting of 21 increments if I take three replicate incremental samples. Now on the other hand, on the other screenshot with the blue box outlines, if I drop down to 20 increments, then it tells me I have to take four incremental samples in order to perform the statistics. Next slide, slide 26. Obviously, the closer the true mean is to the action level, the more samples and increments you need to take in order to come up with a UCL that will come in under the action level. And that's just an example there. With the same data and everything, but if we used 1,000 instead of 3,000 for the gray region, it would have told me to take 7 30-increment samples. Next slide, 27. One thing you have to watch out for with ProUCL is, one thing that's good is you can enter the costs, and the module can optimize the number of increments and incremental samples based on the price of increment collection versus the price of analysis. But when you do that, you have to be careful, because it may say that you can take a lot fewer increments than you really feel comfortable with. VSP will also plot out sampling design coordinates for you, which is a very useful aspect of VSP to develop coordinates without having to plot them out by hand. Going on to slide 28, this is the one I was referring to actually on the previous slide, where VSP can tell you that you can take as low as 7 increments, that's in the red rectangle, it says 4 incremental samples with 7 increments each is the most cost-effective option. That may be the most cost-effective option, but it's not a very good option statistically. Remember that our ability to use VSP, which the multi-increment sampling is based on the assumption of normality for the incremental sample data set. If you deviate too much from the 30 increments, you start to deviate from the assumptions that went into the central limit theorem. So I would never recommend doing only 7 increments per incremental sample. On to slide 28. What about hotspots within a DU? Can we find hotspots? Well, I think you saw from previous presentations that yes, there are ways to find hotspots, but ESP can also help with setting up your sampling design so that you know that you are coming up with hotspots that are being detected. Gene, there's a lot of noise in the background. Do we?
Yeah, I'm sorry about that, Gina. It looks like somebody has locally unmuted their line. This goes for Mike, too. If you're one of the presenters, if you have a mute button on your phone, if you could hit that mute button or use the *6 command to make sure your phone is muted, that would be greatly appreciated. Again, if someone is locally unmuted, it's *6 to remute so that we won't hear that paper background shuffling. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jean. So the density of our increments can be set so that it is more likely that we will find or hit the appropriate number of hotspots to get them into the incremental sample. And visual sample plan can help with that. If we go to slide 30, there's a module called Locating a Hotspot. You can set the dimensions of the hotspot that you want to find, and then it will give you information about how dense your sampling grid should be. One of the interesting things to come out of incremental sampling is, in the past at least, we've had a lot of risk assessors that were afraid that they couldn't find hotspots, so they didn't want to use incremental sampling because they wanted to find hotspots. And we had a case of this where a risk assessor advised against doing incremental sampling, but then signed off on a discrete sample plan that used a grid spacing of 175 feet. Now, you can use VSP to determine how big of a hotspot has to be in order to be detected by a 175-foot grid. And it turns out that a circular hotspot needs to be at least 3/4 of an acre to be detected with that sampling design. And that's a pretty big hotspot. On the other hand, if we had allowed ISM to go forward, they could have used 36 increments within that 175-foot grid, and they would have been sure to hit hotspots as little as a 30th of an acre, 95% of the time. And this isn't statistics, it's just geometry. Slide 31. So this is just showing an example of the output of VSP. So what you would do is VSP recommends, say, a maximum spacing of 35 feet between samples. It's thinking discrete samples, but you would be thinking increments, so 35 feet between increments. And that's the end of the calculations section. Do we have questions?
If you're on the telephone lines, you can unmute by hitting #6. And feel free to identify yourself or organization and ask your question or make a comment. Okay. Is there a comment or question? Okay. I do have some that came in online. And the first question is coming in from Boulder, Colorado. And they ask, is your goal, if your goal is to determine the nature and extent of contamination, and you have a large, apparently homogeneous DU, for example, 5 to 8 acres, and not much site knowledge, number 1, are there any rules of thumb about how many increments to collect versus the size of a DU? And then number 2, how many replicates would be appropriate?
Well, first of all, when we've done most of the statistical work with the ITRC work group and their statisticians, and with the experience that we have with incremental sampling so far, it would be really difficult to cover a 5 to 8 acre DU with increments. We would do one of two things. We would break it down into smaller DUs, say an acre, and if you know it's homogeneous, then potentially you can get away with 30 increments. If you do the three replicates of 30 increments and find that the results don't match very well, that's an indication that you don't have enough increments to handle the amount of variability that's within the DU. What was the last part of the question, Jean?
The last part wanted to know how many replicates would be appropriate.
Yeah. You could still do three replicates. Again, I don't think there's a lot of experience with trying to do such large DUs. It would be better to break them into smaller DUs. But if the area truly is fairly homogeneous, you would not need to do a triplicate at every DU. Only say at one, and if your results are indicating that your 30 increments was sufficient, then you can use the variability, that standard deviation from the three replicate, and apply that standard deviation to the other DUs. There are other ways to sample very large DUs, but there just isn't time to go into that in this seminar.
Okay. There was a comment that came in from Oakland, California, and they state that the concern with hotspots is often, quote, diluting a hotspot by combining with other increments.
Well, what actually... Yep. I'm sorry, was there more?
Nope, that was it.
Okay. If the hotspots have any significant concentration, what's going to happen is less that you're going to be diluting out than you're going to be raising the concentration in your incremental sample. A little contamination can go a long way. And if you are picking up the hot spots in the same ratio that they are in the field, then you're getting a true estimate of the mean, which is what you're after if you're doing risk assessment. You want the concentration for that exposure unit, and that's what you're getting with incremental sampling. So if you want to find hot spots, you have to define what a hot spot is. How big is it, and what concentration should it be? And if you can define a hot spot, we can develop a incremental sampling design that will pick up that size hotspot just by using VSP, as I showed. But if you're thinking that you're going to pick up hotspots that are, you know, the size of 1 gram, that's not going to happen.
Okay. The next question comes in from Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, and they ask, am I understanding correctly that the number of samples that VSP recommends to detect given size hotspots can be interpreted as being instead the spacing of the increments you need an incremental sampling plan to detect a similar sized hotspot?
You are incorporating it into the incremental sample, and if there is sufficient hotspot of sufficient concentration, you will raise the concentration of the incremental sample past some point of whatever your decision threshold is, so it'll flag it as needing to be further investigated.
Okay.
So yes, the sample, the number of samples and the grid spacing of the samples can be translated into the grid spacing of the increments.
Okay, the next question coming in from Colorado, and they'd ask if you could share any thoughts on proportional problem where SD is proportional to mean, or the standard deviation is proportional to the mean.
Well, I assume this refers to when you're borrowing a standard deviation to use it for another DU. If you're looking at DUs that are very different in concentration, even if they have similar RSDs, I would probably not do the borrowing, because the fact is that when you have large differences in concentration from one DU to the other, you're probably also going to have large differences in how that variability is spatially arranged and things. So borrowing a DU, a DU's standard deviation to a different DU might not be appropriate if they're that different.
Okay. I'm going to take one more question online and then see if we have any others from the phones, and then we'll move along. But this next question online is coming from Northport, Washington, and they ask, how do you guess the homogeneity at a DU without a pilot study?
You can have historical data, possibly. It'll be discrete data, but that's what you use to determine the variability between increments. You may have information from a very, very similar site that could be used, but certainly a pilot study is one of the best options if you don't have reliable information from some other source.
Okay. So before we resume with the presentation, does anybody else on the phone lines have a question? If you're on the phones, you'll need to hit #6 to take yourself off of the global mute that I've turned on. And feel free to identify yourself or organization and ask a question.
Hello, this is Lance McMahon in California.
Okay, go ahead, Lance.
If you use a triangular sampling pattern as opposed to a square grid, do you achieve any greater efficiency in the number of samples required?
Yes, VSP in the locating the hotspot module does allow for a triangular grid, and it, from what I understand, the triangular grids are more efficient in hitting hotspots than a rectangular grid. So you could certainly go to a rectangular grid for your increments. I'm sorry, go to a triangular grid. Is that what I said?
Okay, great. Okay, with that, I think we're going to go back to the presentation. If you're on the phone and you have taken yourself off of mute, I'll need you to go hit *6 to remute your phone line. Again, it's *6 to remute. And we can continue on with the presentation on the next slide, which is slide number 33.
Okay, thanks, Jean. Can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you.
Okay, great. Well, my name is Michael Stroh, and I'm with Missouri DNR, and I'm going to talk about a couple of case studies in Missouri where we used incremental sampling. And hopefully you'll recognize some of the concepts that Bob and Dina discussed in the first two modules. I'm going to start with a little background on each of these two sites, and then I'll kind of walk through some of the sampling design. Then I'll finish up, since today is all about calculations for incremental sampling, I'll talk about how we did our calculations to make decisions for each of the sites. So the first site I'll talk about is it's a large multi-county site in northwest Missouri, where leather tannery waste was used as a farm field fertilizer. And then I'll talk about a smaller site. It's a historic lead smelter in south central Missouri. So let's move to slide 34, and we'll start with the first case study. What you see here is an aerial photograph of a four-county area in northwest Missouri. And over in the center left side of this map, you see a red star, and that's the location of one of the largest leather tanneries in North America. It's in St. Joseph, Missouri, which is right along the Missouri River. And they used a chromium tanning process, and that process generated a sludge from their wastewater treatment plant. It basically consisted mostly of little bits of hair and hide. So it was very high in nitrogen and phosphorus, and it made a great fertilizer, which they offered to farmers in the area for free as a fertilizer. And they did that for about a 26-year period starting in the early 80s. So all these little yellow polygons you see on this map are individual farm fields that receive this sludge. In all, there were about 100 farm fields covering about 10,000 acres. I mentioned this was a chromium-based tanning operation, and most of you are probably familiar with the fact that chromium exists primarily in two forms in the environment, a trivalent form, which is actually an essential nutrient in our diet, and hexavalent chromium, which is a human carcinogen. So there was concern raised in late 2008, early 2009, about whether there might be residual levels of this hexavalent form of chromium in the sludge that might be presenting a health threat to farmers and nearby residents. So let's move to slide 35. These are a couple of photos that we took at the tanning facility. The one on the left shows a storage bay where the sludge was stored prior to loading out onto trucks and transport to the farm fields. And the photo on the right just shows some of the type of equipment that was used to spread the sludge in the farm fields. And again, this was done by employees of the tannery at no cost to the farmers. Let's move to slide 36. This is a photograph that we took in one of the pastures that got the sludge application. And it's just to show that there was a visual footprint to this sludge material. And you can see here in the yellow polygon a little bit more of this reddish-brown color than in the blue polygon. And if you could actually zoom in here on this photograph, you would see bits of hair fibers. Let's go to slide 37. This site was the first site in Missouri where we used an incremental sampling approach. And as Dina mentioned in day one, an important part of incremental sampling, and really an important part of any kind of sampling, is the systematic planning process. And one of the first steps of that is to identify your study question. You see our study question here on the slide. We were interested in estimating the mean concentration of hexavalent chromium in the fine particulate fraction of farm field surface soils, which we defined as the top 2 inches. And we wanted to compare that to a screening level that risk assessors at EPA Region 7 developed for us, specifically for this site, of 86 parts per million. Now, we're interested in this fine particulate fraction specifically because that's the fraction of soil most likely to be picked up and transported in dust or to be made available for farmers to breathe and be exposed to. Let's move to slide 38. Please don't try to read anything in this table. I just included it here to give you an idea of the type of information that we were able to obtain. This was most of these sludge applications were actually done as permitted. They were permitted by our agency, and some of the conditions of that permit was that the tanner had to keep records about the sludge applications. And we were able to obtain those, so we had quite a bit of information. We knew where the sludge was applied. We actually had latitude, longitude coordinates. We had contact information for each of the farmers. We knew when the sludge was applied and how often. And we even had information about the pounds of chromium applied per acre, as you see where I circled that in red on the right side of this table. So we're usually not so fortunate to have such a large amount of information from which to develop a conceptual site model as we were at this site. Let's go to the next slide, slide 39. Now this is that same aerial photograph we saw before showing the sludge applied farm fields. So we used this information from the tannery to identify a subset of the worst case farm fields. It really wasn't practical for us to go out to each 100 of the 100 plus farm fields. So the idea was we would select these 20 farm fields initially as worst case farm fields and take a look at those, and then if they were to come back clean, we would have a fairly high confidence that the farm fields we didn't sample would also be clean. So you see on these two inset maps here, on this photo, where we're zooming into two individual farm fields. Our risk assessors, as part of their exposure assessment, they determined that the typical size of a farm field in this part of Missouri is about 80 acres. And so that's the exposure unit that they used when they developed the site-specific screening level. So when we designed our sampling, we set our decision units equal to this exposure unit. So our goal then is to obtain an estimate of the mean hexavalent chromium concentration in each of these 20 80-acre decision units. But 80 acres is still a pretty big area. So to make the sampling more manageable, we divided each of the decision units up into 1-acre sampling units. And you see those here as the red squares in each of these two decision units. So this is the scale at which we would be doing our incremental sampling. Let's move to the next slide, slide 40. We conducted a demonstration of method applicability. It's more commonly known as a pilot study. And this is not something that we normally do, but considering the scope and complexity of this particular site, it was warranted. And I've listed some of the goals of the pilot study on the left side here of this slide. We wanted to, there's a couple different ways you can analyze for hexavalent chromium. We wanted to evaluate the method we've chosen and make sure that it had the sensitivity and precision that we needed to make a decision. We also wanted to see if it would be feasible to use XRF as a field analytical method to help us determine sampling density in the field. I recall those of you that have used XRF know that it's not capable of distinguishing between different forms of chromium. Can only see total chromium. So we needed to find out whether there was some sort of relationship between total and hexavalent chromium such that we could use the total chromium concentration sort of as a proxy. We also wanted to test out some of our conceptual site model assumptions in this pilot study. The pilot study would also give us some initial estimates of the type of chromium concentrations we might expect to see and how that varied across different spatial scales. And the way we did that was to set up varioplots. You see one here in this photograph on the right side of the slide. A varioplot's just basically an area you flag out that we flagged out in the farm fields, and we did three of these. And then we collected discrete samples at 10 different locations. And, as you see, those are the blue dots in this figure. And then those each of those samples can be analyzed for total and hexavalent chromium, and that'll give us an idea of how these two forms of chromium vary across different spatial scales by looking at the distances between these different points. And so those blue lines represent the different combinations of distances. All this information from the pilot study was then useful as input for our incremental sampling design, as you'll see. Let's go on to slide 41. So here's some of the findings from our pilot study. It turned out that the variability of total chromium and hexavalent chromium was very similar at different spatial scales. There was enough total chromium present in the farm field soils that we could detect it with the XRF. So the XRF would be a useful tool for us. Probably the most important finding, though, from the pilot study was we identified a very significant positive bias in the analytical method we were using. We're actually seeing an order of magnitude higher concentrations for hexavalent chromium than were actually present in the samples due to a positive matrix interference. So it was really great that we were able to identify that during the pilot study before we had gone out and collected all of our full-scale investigation samples. We are able to identify another analytical method that didn't suffer from this bias. And the pilot study gave us some initial estimates of the type of sampling density we might be required. And you see those here under this last bullet. And we'll talk about that more here in a minute. Let's go on to slide 42. So in the next couple slides, I'm going to kind of walk you through the our sampling design. First, we needed to, and this photograph on the right side is one of the farm field decision units with its grid of 1 acre sampling units. So first, we needed to select individual 1 acre sampling units in which we would do our sampling. And we did that by trying to select sampling units that would maximize heterogeneity both within the sampling unit and between the sampling units. So, for example, this sampling unit in the upper right corner here, that might have been an area of the farm field that was in an upland, very level upland area where you might expect more uniform concentrations. The one down in the lower right might have been in a part of the landscape where there were dips and swales, and you might expect to see the sludge concentrating there through surface water runoffs. You might expect higher concentrations there. And maybe the one in the middle had some sort of combination of those landscape features. And we selected those by actually traversing the farm fields in ATVs and taking a look at them. Once we had picked our three sampling units, we needed to find out how many increments each of our composite samples should contain. And this series of colored rectangles you see on the right side of the slide kind of walk us through that process. So our pilot study told us that 10 increments per sampling unit would probably be about in the ballpark. So we started out by collecting 10 increments of soil in each sampling unit. And we analyzed each one of those increments by XRF. And that gave us a mean and a standard deviation for total chromium. And that information was fed into visual sampling plan. And we asked the question, would 10 increments of soil be enough if we were actually just making decisions on this 1 acre sampling unit? If it wasn't, we would go back and collect more increments until we had enough. And once we had enough, we would then combine all those increments together to form an incremental sample that represented that 1 acre sampling unit. And then this whole process was repeated for the other two sampling units. So this is a little bit different than the increment averaging approach that was discussed on the first couple days of this training, where you typically see in smaller decision units that you're breaking up into sampling units, you'll typically see sampling done in every single one of the sampling units, where here we're just going to take a look at a couple of the sampling units, a few of them, and then try and draw conclusions about the larger decision unit based on those results. So let's move on to slide 43. What you see here, this is the photograph of us flagging out one of the 1 acre sampling units. We use GIS tools in the office to lay these 1 acre sampling grids out across our farm fields and assign them arbitrary numbers, and then we put those maps onto handheld GPS units, and that's what we used in the field to navigate to the corners of each of our sampling units. Let's move on to the next slide, slide 44. And here you see this is a screenshot of visual sampling plan showing the results for a single 1 acre sampling unit. Now, this is an older version of visual sampling plan. It was before they had actually developed the multi-increment sampling module of software. It's basically the same concept. So we're entering in here towards the top our decision error tolerance. We used a 95% confidence level. And then we needed to enter in the width of the gray region. And remember that width of the gray region is simply the difference between the action level and the mean. We also need an action level. Now, we had a screening level but it was for hexavalent chromium. And here, all this information we're entering here is from our XRF analysis, so it's total chromium. So we needed to convert that hexavalent chromium action level into one for total chromium. And we did that using the pilot study data. We looked at the ratios of the two from our pilot study, and we picked the worst case ratio, and we actually multiplied that by 3 to be extra protective. And we came up with about 1,700 parts per million as a total chromium action level. And then we entered in our standard deviation from those 10 pink soil that we analyzed by XRF. We can see down here at the bottom, visual sampling plan tells us that for this 1 acre sampling unit, 3 increments of soil would have been sufficient to make a decision. Well, we had already collected 10, so for this sampling unit, we simply needed to combine those 10 increments of soil together to form our increment composite sample. And this, so this sort of analysis was done for every sampling unit that we sampled in. Okay, well, there were 60 overall. Let's go to slide 45. So the second step in our design, once we knew how many increments we needed in each of the sampling units, we needed to determine how many sampling units we needed to sample in each decision unit. Well, our pilot study told us that 5 would be pretty close, so we started out with 3. And the 3 that we had gotten from the first step. So we have analyzed each of those 3 incremental composite samples with the XRF, and that gave us a total chromium mean and standard deviation. And then again, we entered that information into visual sampling plan and asked whether that was enough or whether we would need to sample in more 1 acre sampling units. We would go out and collect those additional 1 acre sampling units until we had enough. And then all of those would be submitted to the laboratory for hexavalent chromium analysis. Now, to actually make our decisions about the farm fields, we would use those results that came back from the lab for each of these 1 acre sampling units. We would use those together to calculate an upper confidence level. And then that's the number that would be compared to the screening level. And I'll show you that calculation here in a few slides. Let's go to the next slide, slide 46. So this is a series of photographs that kind of take us through the sample processing steps that we did for these samples. When they were brought back in from the field, each the samples were laid out to air dry. And then we disaggregated them to break up the clumps manually using a mallet. Once the samples were disaggregated, they were passed through a number 60 sieve. So this is where we're obtaining just the particle size of interest, just that fine particle size fraction. And then the samples were the sieve samples were then analyzed by XRF. So let's go to slide 47. So I just hit on some of the main findings from the investigation. We had very low hexavalent chromium concentrations and variability in all of the sampling units in the farm fields that we looked at. As I mentioned, we looked in 61 acre sampling units. None of those sampling units required more than 10 increments to be included in each incremental sample. And of the 20 decision units we looked at, none of them required more than the initial 3 1-acre sampling units that we sampled. And the key factor here is this distance between the mean and the screening level, which is what VSP calls the width of the gray region. So we had fairly easy decisions, and we could have a high confidence about extrapolating the decisions that we made on the decision on the farm fields we looked at to ones that were not sampled. Let's go on to slide 48 and take a look at the calculation that we did for each decision unit. So you see the same farm field decision unit here in the photograph on the left side of this slide. The incremental samples from each of the sampling units were submitted for hexavalent chromium analysis, and you see the results here in the table in the center of the slide. Well, we then calculated a mean and a standard deviation. And then we use that information to calculate an upper confidence limit. The equation that you've seen before from the earlier modules, this is the equation for the t-statistic upper confidence limit. Now remember though, that this t-statistic confidence limit assumes an underlying distribution that's normally distributed. Well, that's probably not a good assumption for this sampling design, because what we're looking at here are results from individual 1 acre sampling units across the farm field. So they're probably going to behave more like discrete samples, and we would expect more of a skewed distribution, as opposed to if you had collected, for example, 3 replicate incremental samples across the entire decision unit, where you might expect to see a more normal distribution. So we actually used both this method to calculate the UCL and the non-parametric method called the Chebyshev method for calculating a UCL that does not rely on any assumptions about the underlying distribution. It turned out really not to matter that much. You can see the UCL here that I circled in green using the t-statistic method, 5.3 parts per million. That is still an order of magnitude below the screening level of 86 parts per million. And if we use the Chebyshev method, we get a result slightly higher than this, but still an order of magnitude below the screening level. And actually, the result for this particular DU we're looking at here was the worst case. So this was the highest concentration we saw in any farm field DU. Let's go on to slide 49. So Gina talked about the importance of collecting replicate incremental samples. And we collected replicates in some of the 1 acre sampling units that we looked at. And this is a little bit different than the way you would normally see replicates collected. Here we're not collecting replicates across an entire decision unit and using them to calculate a UCL. Instead, we're just using them as a quality control metric to look at the overall sampling and analysis precision. So the photograph here on the left, you see with the red dots, you see how we collected the replicates. 10 increments were collected in yellow, and then we swept back through the sampling unit, collecting another set of 10 from independent locations, and then we did that a third time. And the table here to the right shows the results for hexavalent chromium on those replicates for 3 different 1 acre sampling units. And you see the measure of variability here expressed as a relative standard deviation in the far right column. For this project, we established a data quality objective for this RSD at 30%. And as you can see, none of the results exceeded that DQO, indicating that the overall sampling and analysis error were fairly well controlled. Well, let's go on to slide 50 then. So we were also interested in what portion of this overall sampling and analysis error might be coming specifically from the subsampling procedures at the laboratory. For this hexavalent chromium analytical method, the lab really, they only needed 1 gram for the digestion and analysis. So instead of the typical sort of dig a scoop off the top of the jar method, we asked the lab to instead spread the entire sample out and then obtain this 1 gram from 10.1 gram aliquots collected throughout the sample mass. And you see this process in the photo on the left. We also asked the lab to conduct replicate digestion and analyses on some of the samples. And the table to the right shows the results for those replicate pairs and the variability between them here expressed as a relative percent difference in the column to the far right. So you can see from these very low RPDs that at least for this project, the subsampling procedures at the lab were contributing really not very much to the overall sampling error. So for this project, it's really not an important source of error, but it may be at sites, and particularly, if you've got overall sampling and analysis precision that's interfering with your ability to make a decision. So maybe your UCL and your mean are straddling an action level. You might need to drill down and find out what the sources, what some of the contributors are to that overall sampling analysis error, and you can take a look at this subsampling error at the lab as one of the possible sources so you can determine where corrective actions might be necessary. Okay, let's take a look at slide 51, and this just summarizes some of the important points on this case study. This was an increment averaging approach, which was discussed in day one, but it was kind of a hybrid of that. So, because we weren't looking in every single sampling unit across the entire decision unit, we're only looking in some and then drawing conclusions about the whole. And we did that, we justified doing that based on our strong conceptual site model that was based on all the information we got from the tannery. For us, a pilot study was really key for us, particularly to identify and correct that problem with the analytical method. That saved us a lot of grief down the road during the full-scale study. And the XRF, using the XRF as a dynamic tool in the field to, together with visual sampling plan, really helped us to zero in on just the density of sampling that we needed in order to make our decision. Low concentrations and standard deviations we observed in the farm fields allowed fairly easy decisions with really low density sampling. Okay, well let's look at the next case study on slide 52. So this is a lead smelter. Missouri was the world's leading lead producer for almost a century. And so we've got a lot of very large, sort of mega Superfund sites. But we've also got a number of these smaller operations scattered throughout the southern part of the state. And this is one of those. This is a smelter that's located in what's now a public conservation area. And you see a map of that to the left here. The smelter is located near what's now a developed campground in the conservation area. And the photo on the right shows a zooming in to that part of the conservation area. And you can see the campsite area here in the lower part of this photo, and then the area that was actually where the mining was actually done, a little bit north of there on a hilltop. Let's go on to slide 53. So we had some historic records for this smelter. We knew that it used an older masonry style of furnace called a reverberatory furnace, which was basically just stacked blocks of limestone. We had an approximate location for the smelter based on a sketch in a field book. It got us in the area of the campground, but we didn't know exactly where it was, and there were no visual remains of it. We also knew, based on production records, that there was very little lead produced at this particular smelter. Let's move to slide 54. There's a couple photographs we took at this site. The one on the left is a mine shaft that's located on that hilltop north of the campground area. And the upper right photograph is just a picture of one of the campsites. Now, these were fairly small campsites. Each one was about the same size, and they were about 2,000 square feet each. So here's our study question for this site. We were interested in an estimate of the mean lead concentration in the fine particulate fraction, again, the surface soil, of each of the campsites. And then we were wanted to know whether those mean concentrations exceeded the screening level. This investigation hasn't been completed yet. Our state risk assessors are currently working on develop a site-specific screening level for this sort of recreational land use. So we don't know what that screening level is going to be yet, but other similar sites we've looked at, it's been in the range of 800 to 1,000 parts per million. Well, let's look at the next slide, slide 56. Well, if you look at some of the existing guidance that's out there right now, the states of Hawaii and Alaska have published guidance on incremental sampling. Corps of Engineers has some guidance specifically for munitions and metals at firing ranges. And the ITRC team has recently published a web-based document on incremental sampling methodology. And all of those sources, you'll find some sort of minimum number of increments per incremental sample. And typically you see 30 recommended as a minimum. And then you'll often see recommendations for a minimum of 3 replicate sample, incremental samples per decision unit. Well, for this particular site, we had 10 decision units, if you include the background and a couple of subsurface decision units. So if we do the math here, we can see that for this site, we would need to collect 900 increments of surface soil. And for the subsurface DUs, we'd need to dig 180 pits, which we plan to do by hand. So that sounded like a lot of work, and we asked the question of whether that was warranted at this is a screening level assessment. It's a recreational site in a fairly remote public area. And it's generally only used a couple months a year during deer hunting season. Let's look at slide 57. So we use this approach. We plan to use in situ XRF to look at the lead concentrations and try to get an estimate of the mean and variability across the campground. In situ XRF would also identify any hot spots across the campground, and maybe some of the campsites were closer to the smelter than others and might have higher concentrations. And this, we could use this information to design a more streamlined incremental composite sampling approach. Let's go to the next slide, slide 58. So this is just a cartoon sketch of the campground. And you see the 6 campsites here. The X's within the campsites are locations of in-situ XRF readings. Most of these are surface soil, but some of them, particularly the ones that are clustered together, are subsurface, where we dug some test pits and took XRF readings at different depths. So one thing to notice here, and I've circled these, I've put these two different colored polygons on the map here. The one in blue, in campsites 3, 4, 5, and 6, we saw much lower concentrations of lead and a lower standard deviation. And in campsites 1 and 2, we saw quite a bit higher concentrations and standard deviations. And the subsurface sampling results showed us that lead concentrations and variability was very similar in campgrounds 1 and 2 in the subsurface as it was in the surface. And we saw very little subsurface lead in campgrounds 3, 4, 5, and 6. So we translated those findings into a study design, and let's take a look at slide 59. So based on these XRF findings, we developed an incremental composite sampling design where we would collect fewer increments in the campsite decision units where we saw these lower concentrations and variability. And that's campgrounds 3, 4, 5, and 6. So we would collect fewer increments there and no replicates. In campgrounds 1 and 2, where we saw concentrations that were higher and really close at what might be a screening level, we would collect more increments. We would collect 30 increments in each of those decision units. And we would collect three replicates in each of those. Now, for the subsurface decision units in campsites 1 and 2, we would collect fewer increments and no replicates. And there we're going to derive estimates of standard deviation from the surface, since we observe very similar trends between the surface and subsurface with the XRF. So these decisions we're making are going to really reduce our level of effort that's required in the field at this site, which is good. But as you'll see, there's going to be some consequences that we're going to have to pay in higher data variability. Let's go to slide 60. And here's just some photographs showing the sample collection. We used one of the commercially available incremental sampling tools, which allowed us to collect these samples very efficiently. We were able to complete the sample collection, including the XRF work and subsurface sampling, in about 8 hours total. Let's go to slide 61. So here's our sample processing for this site. It's very similar to the other site. But with incremental sampling tools, with these special tools that have been designed, you end up with, oftentimes you'll end up with these pellets of soil, as you see in the top center photograph here. And we found if you just let those air dry, they tend to dry into really hard little golf ball clumps of soil that are hard to disaggregate. So what we found is that it's better to, when you get those samples back from the field, it's better to sort of disaggregate those right away. You see that in this top left photograph here, where we're just breaking the clods apart. In the center photograph, you sort of see the before and after. And once the samples were air dried, we returned them to the bag and disaggregated them manually with the rubber mallet. And as we saw before, we passed them through the sieve to obtain our fine particle size of interest, and then analyze them by XRF. So let's go to slide 62. So for the next series of slides, I'm going to talk about how we calculated upper confidence levels for each of the decision units, and how those calculation methods differ sort of as a consequence of the sampling design and the types of data that we had. First, let's take a look at decision units number 1 and 2. So these are the campsites with the higher concentrations. And here we had three replicate 30-increment composite samples. So, and you can see the results for those in this table to the left. One thing that you might notice right away is that these concentrations are much higher than we saw with the in situ XRF readings for those two, for this particular campground. We were getting readings more in the 400 or 500 part per million range with the in situ XRF. And there's a couple reasons that might explain that. When we did the in situ XRF readings, the soil was quite wet. And those of you that have used an XRF know that soil moisture can interfere with the readings. But also, in situ XRF is looking at the bulk soil. It's looking at all the different particle sizes that are present in bulk soil. And here, we're looking at only the fine particle fraction with the incremental composite samples. And as you might recall from the first day, Gina was talking about particle size effects and the nugget effect and so forth. You tend to see, especially with metals, you tend to see higher concentrations as you look at the finer particle sizes. And so that probably also explains some of the difference here. So we get an estimate of the mean and standard deviation from these replicates, and we can put that information into the T-statistic UCL equation that we've seen before. For this DU, we get a result of about 1,400 parts per million. So this is this is probably going to be slightly above the screening level, that depending on what it turns out to be, but probably this decision unit is going to require some sort of removal action. Let's go on to the next slide, slide 63, and we can take a look at how we calculated UCLs for the subsurface decision units for campsites 1 and 2. So here, we didn't collect any replicates. Without replicates, we have no estimate of the standard deviation, so we can't calculate a UCL. So instead, we borrowed a standard deviation from the surface soil sampling, and we justified doing that based on the similarity we saw with the in situ XRF between the surface and subsurface. We used the relationship. There's a relationship between the standard deviation of the mean and the standard deviation of the samples that make up that mean. And we can use that to derive an estimate of standard deviation from the surface soil samples. And we'll kind of look at that in a couple of steps here. This is the equation here for that relationship. You see below step one here. The standard deviation of our between our samples, between our 90 increments for the surface soil, is equal to the standard deviation of the replicates, which is the standard deviation of the mean, times the number of samples. And so if we enter in the standard deviation we saw for the surface soil samples of 75 parts per million from the previous slide, and square root of n here is 90 because we had 330 increment samples that went into that standard deviation, we get standard deviation between the 90 increments of 710 parts per million. But we didn't collect 90 increments in the subsurface. We only collected 15. So in step two here, we can derive an estimate of standard deviation for 15 increments using the same equation and just rearranging it a little. We can solve for the standard deviation for 15 increments. We use the 710 part per million standard deviation for 90 increments and divide that by the square root of n, which would be 15. And we get about 183 parts per million. So this is what this represents, is an estimate of the standard deviation that we might expect if we had actually collected 3 15 increment replicates in the subsurface of these two of this particular decision unit. And notice how much higher this is than the standard deviation from the surface incremental samples of 75 parts per million. And that's a consequence of having to derive the standard deviation and make these assumptions. Now, I would expect if we had actually collected 3 15 increment samples in the subsurface, we probably would have gotten a much lower standard deviation than 183. But we have to live with that. So let's go on to slide 64. All right, now that we have an estimate of variability for the subsurface DUs, we can use the same equation as before, the t-statistic UCL, to calculate an upper confidence level. And you see that here. So we enter in for decision unit 1, we actually measured about 1,700 parts per million in the sample we collected. And we can use this 183 part per million standard deviation that we derived from the sort of simulated, if we had simulation of having collected 3 15 increment replicates. And we get a UCL of about 2,000 parts per million. Well, this is, you might notice that this is quite a bit higher than the 1,700 part per million mean. It's about 20% higher. That's compared to, in the surface, our UCL was only about 8% higher than the mean. So this is the penalty that we have to pay for not having collected subsurface replicates and having to settle for this conservative estimate of variability that we derive from surface soil samples. Let's go on to slide 65. Well, but so what about the other decision units? We have these other campsites 3, 4, 5, and 6 where we didn't collect any replicates, so again, we don't have an estimate of standard deviation. But here, we saw quite a bit different concentrations, different estimates of the mean with our in situ sampling. So it's probably not as defensible to just borrow a standard deviation that we got from campsites 1 and 2 to these other campsites. Well, instead, what we can do is treat this group of campsites together as a separate population. And we can use some of the tools in ProUCL to take a look at the distribution among that population and to calculate an appropriate UCL. So let's step through that. And let's move on to slide 66. It's always important to have some understanding about the distribution, underlying distribution that you might be dealing with. And ProUCL has a tool that will generate QQ plots. And a QQ plot is basically just a graphical way to look at your data. It's plotting your data against quantiles that were generated from a theoretical normally distributed population. What you would want to see is a straight 45 degree line. That would indicate that your data is coming from a normal distribution. Any sort of different slope or break in the slope would indicate a non-normal distribution or maybe that you're looking at two separate populations. So the graph you see here on the left is our raw data for this other group of campgrounds, 3, 4, 5, and 6. There was also a future campground here indicated by the F on this slide, and that was an area that that was being considered for development into another campsite, which we are also assessed and had low concentrations. Obviously, this is not a straight 45-degree line, so we're probably not looking at a normally distributed data set here. And we transformed the data by taking the log of it and then plotted that information, and you see that in the QQ plot to the right. So here's a fairly straight, more or less 45-degree line, indicating that we probably have a log normally distributed data set. And ProUCL has tools for calculating UCLs from a number different distributions, including log normal. Let's move on then to slide 67. And you'll see here, this is a screenshot from the output from ProUCL for calculating an upper confidence level from this group of campsites. So for the whole group, we have a mean that I circled in green here of about 236 parts per million. And we use the Chevy, we have ProUCL calculated a UCL using the Chebyshev method, so this doesn't rely on any underlying distribution. We get a UCL for the group of about 500 parts per million. So quite a bit higher than the mean, where it's almost 50% higher than the mean. And that's a consequence of not being able to rely on a normal distribution. We're using a non-parametric calculation method. Okay, let's go to slide 68. So we can kind of put all this together now. We can use the difference between this group UCL and the group mean as a measure of uncertainty for the whole data set. And then we can take that measure of uncertainty and apply it to the result from each decision unit, and that will give us a conservative estimate of the mean for each campsite. And so we see that calculation in the table here to the right. In the bullets to the left here, I'm kind of stepping us through. So we have a UCL from the previous slide of 505 parts per million. And when we subtract that from the mean, or rather subtract the mean from the UCL, we get about 268 parts per million. So that represents our measure of uncertainty for the group. And in the table to the right, we're applying that to each of the decision units. So for example, for decision unit 3, we actually measured 134 parts per million in the sample we analyzed. When we add in this measure of uncertainty, we get 402 parts per million. So this is the number we would actually compare to the screening level to make a decision unit about this campsite. You might notice how much higher these estimates are than what we actually measured in the decision units. So there's a big penalty to pay in data variability here for not having collected replicates in each of the decision units. For example, if we take a look at decision unit number 4, here we're measuring 100 parts per million, but we're having to live with an estimate of the mean of 373 parts per million, so significantly higher. Ultimately, though, what really matters is whether the amount of variability interferes with your decision, your ability to make a decision. And we don't know yet what the screening level is going to be for this site, but if it's similar to what we've seen at other similar sites in the 800 to 1,000 part per million range, then even accounting for this level of data variability, it's not going to interfere with our ability to make a decision that at least these campgrounds probably aren't going to require any kind of removal action. So let's go on to slide 69 and just look at a quick summary here. So some of the key concepts, it was an increment averaging goal for us. We were interested in estimates of the mean for our decision units. We used the XRF, in-situ XRF results were used to help us refine a conceptual site model and to guide a less dense incremental composite sampling design. This lower density design, we extrapolated measures of variability across the DUs, which was saved us quite a bit of time in the field, but resulted in sort of a penalty paid of higher estimates of the UCL. For this particular site, fortunately didn't interfere with our ability to make a decision. But if it had, we would need to go back out. One of the things we might want to do is go back out and collect more increments and more replicates to get better estimates of the mean. Well, that's it on the case studies. I guess, Jean, I'll send it back to you for questions.
Sure, thank you. We're going to take questions by both phone as well as the ones that have been typed up electronically. In the interest of time, I'm going to start with the ones that have come in electronically, and then we'll switch over to people on the phone. So this first question that came in online is coming in from Oakland, California. And they're asking what CRVI analytical method has a tenfold positive bias.
Yeah, we initially used method 7199, SW846 method 7199, and that's an alkaline digestion with liquid. I believe it uses ion chromatography, and then a colorimetric detection. There's some particular matrix effect in these samples that was causing extremely high readings with that method. The method that we ended up using was, it's basically just a modification of 7199, which is pretty much identical except for the detection was with a mass spectrometer. And so that eliminated this matrix effect for these particular samples.
Okay. The next question is actually coming in from Portugal. And they ask, consider a site where several similar DUs would be defined. For example, a site containing several old deposition basins, and they have received a very similar sort of sludge in the past. Would it be appropriate to calculate the SD for only one of the basins using discrete data and assume that SD for all of the other basins it would be the same as the one calculated for the purpose of the UCL calculations for IMF.
Well, I guess that the answer to that would be maybe. I probably personally wouldn't recommend doing that without some information to support that. You know, depending on the type of contaminant, there might be a field analytical method that you could use to validate that assumption before you did that sort of extrapolation. Or there may be some other kind of information you could use to justify doing that. But I guess I wouldn't automatically make that kind of assumption and extrapolate a measure of variability across decision units.
Okay. The next question is coming in from Honolulu, Hawaii, and they ask, for the CRVI example, aren't your SUs essentially the same as really good discrete samples in the 80-acre exposure area DU?
Yeah, I think that might be a good way to think about them. I mean, they were composite samples. They consisted of 10 increments each. But the way we were using them statistically was very similar to the way that you might use discrete samples. So, yeah, I think that might be a good way to think about that.
Okay. The next question comes in from Idaho, and they're asking, in the second case study, the data appeared to fit the log normal distribution. Is there no other option for calculating its UCL besides the non-parametric method? And this is referring back to slides 13 and 14.
You know, I'm not a statistician. We had 5 data points there. So, I mean, ProUCL generally recommends a minimum of 8, for the stability of the algorithms. So with a data set of 8, I don't think I would use ProUCL tools to calculate a UCL. Now we did use it for the Chebyshev method, but for that method, it's a non-parametric method, so it's basically the same as that really simple formula that Dina showed in the first part of the module. We could have gotten the same result using the Excel spreadsheet tools that she's got a link for on the links page to do that calculation.
Okay. Again, we have another question from Hawaii, and they're asking, did you collect 30 increment IS samples in campsites 3 through 6 and then test the find?
No, we collected 15 increment composite samples from those campsites and no replicates there.
Okay.
But we did look at the finds, and all the samples we're only looking at a particular particle size fraction, the very fine fraction.
Okay. Our next question from Sacramento, California. Since the lab results effectively show the limitations using in-situ XRF, and since the XRF was such a key component of the original sample design, for example, slides 57 and 58, doesn't this call into question the sample design used for sites 3 through 6 and the conclusion drawn thereto on slide 65? Or in other words, why use the XRF for the sample design in the first place, considering the soil characteristics you mentioned?
Well, the XRF is giving us information about relative concentrations in the different campsites. So, and that's the part of that data that was used for the design, not so much the specific concentrations we were seeing as the relative concentrations and standard deviation in those different campsites. And so for that use, I think it was appropriate. If we were actually trying to make decisions based on the XRF data, we probably would have not used them or waited until soil moisture conditions were drier. I wouldn't make decisions with in situ XRF data unless I had a whole bunch of readings because of the those higher data variability, because you're only looking at such small areas with the XRF, like a couple square centimeters for each reading.
Okay. We're going to do one more question online, and then I'll switch over to the phone line. Again, if you have a question or comment that you haven't typed up electronically, you may continue to do so using the question mark icon that appears on the top of your slide. And we'll certainly take our time with the remaining minutes we have to answer as many questions as we can. So this next question that I have from an online participant in Portland, they asked, if you sieve the sample after combining increments, how can you be sure of getting equal mass per increment?
Well, we weighed them. We didn't get the same. So when we sieved the samples, we didn't get the same, say, percentage of soil coming out the other end of the sieve for all the samples, because there's some variability in the soil types from location to location in the farm field. But once we had obtained the sieved portion of the samples, we combined equal masses of those together, so that our incremental sample consisted of equal masses of each of the increments, so 10 increments that we had collected.
Okay, thank you. Let's switch over to the phone line participants. If you're on the phone and you have a question, you can take yourself off of mute by hitting #6, and then we'd ask you to identify yourself or your organization and then ask your question. Okay, I don't hear anybody on the phone line. I do have two questions that came in from the earlier portion of today's session. These are in relation to Dina's part of the presentation. So, Dina, if you've muted, you may need to hit #6 to unmute. But this first question I'm going to take online is from San Francisco, California, and they ask, in using MIS for searching for hotspots, doesn't incremental sampling just become a large composite sample, in which case any smaller hotspots just become diluted?
First of all, you wouldn't use MIS to search for hotspots, because the goal of MIS is to derive an average for the decision unit. So what you get is, with the density in incremental sampling, you are more likely to incorporate hotspots into that estimate of the average instead of miss them entirely and maybe have a completely unrealistic and very low estimate of the average. Was there more to that question? Or is that it?
Nope, that was it. And the only other question I had, this was a simple one, and they asked us to hold it unless we had time. So this is in reference to slide number 12, and they'd ask you to define what T is.
Oh. T is a statistical parameter that you read off of a big table, and the value of it depends on how many samples you have on N. And it depends on what kind of confidence you want. So you can just think of it as a statistical parameter that's specific to a T distribution, and it's dependent on those two factors. So in a table, you look it up based on how many samples do you have and what confidence do you want.
Okay, great. One last check to see if anybody on the phone lines has a question or comment. Again, it's #6 to unmute, and feel free to ask your question. Okay. I don't see any other questions in the online queue. You guys have managed to get through everything that people submitted today. So before we close things out, Dina or Mike, would you guys like to make any final statements?
I can't think of anything.
Okay.
No, I think that's, well, I forgot to mention there's a website, a URL for a website on the links page that will take you to our agency website for that tannery site, that hexavalent chromium site, with a lot more information if you're interested.
Okay, great. Thank you. Well, with that, I'm going to start the closeout procedures here. I'll direct everyone to move to the final slide, which is slide number 70. And on slide number 70, you'll see two very important links. The first one is a link to the additional resources or links page that was put together for today's seminar. And it's on that page, you'll be able to download a copy of the presentation materials, as well as a number of the resources that were discussed in today's presentation, including Dina's Excel spreadsheet and the link that Mike just mentioned. The other link you'll see on slide 70 is a link to our short feedback form. We would ask that you take just a moment to fill that out. If you thought this was useful training, you'd like to see more of them delivered this way. It's only by getting feedback like that that we can continue to offer free technical training through CLUIN. So please be sure to take a moment to fill that out. If you shared the line with multiple participants or you're looking to get some sort of confirmation of your participation today for CEUs or PEHs, when you fill out the feedback form, there'll be a box you can check, and it'll send an email confirmation to you for your records, at least verifying that you did participate and submit feedback. If you share the line, once you submit feedback for one person, there will be a link that will appear that will allow another person to sign on and provide their own feedback. If you're not at a computer with active internet or only have printed copies of the materials, both of those links are available at the seminar homepage. You'll see buttons on the left side as well as links at the very bottom, again, which will bring you to the resources and the links page and our short feedback form. So with that, a few minutes early, I will close everything out today. I want to extend my thanks to both of our presenters, Dina as well as Mike, for joining us and putting this material together. And I also want to thank the over 300 people that we managed to get on a Friday afternoon, which is a great turnout on CLUIN, to participate in Module 3 for this Internet seminar on incremental composite sampling designs for surface soil analyses. The fourth and final module will be delivered next week on February 27th at 2 p.m. at Eastern Time. If you haven't signed up for that session, you can do so now by visiting CLUIN.org/training, and you'll find it on our training calendar. For those of you that may have experienced audio problems today, I did have one or two people reporting the issue. We did get a complete capture of the full recording and the full session without disruption. So, again, all participants will receive an automatic email notifying you as soon as that archive for Module 3 is available. So if you think you missed anything, you'll be able to play that back in a short period of time. So with that, again, I extend my thanks to everyone, and this will be the formal conclusion for today's Internet seminar. I hope you all have a great rest of your day, and that I'll see you or hear from you soon on a future CLUIN Internet seminar. Thanks so much.